And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with The Black Horse, who is a Canadian content creator. I don't know how to address you. Should I say Mr. Horse?
Sure, Mr. Horse is sufficient. Thank you for having me on. I think I've watched almost all 10 years of Millennial. A bit of a trip to be on. I've done a lot of these, but some of them are special.
Right. Well, thank you for being a loyal viewer. Can you describe and introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. So I've kicked around the scene for a long time, primarily as an observer. I was reading, for example, Unqualified Reservations back in the Obama administration. So I've had pretty long-standing views, but I didn't get interested in expressing my views online really until the Great Apocalypse, which was COVID in Canada in 2020. Prior to that, my views on politics were driven by the philosophy of parallelism. I believe that the correct way to deal with the problems that were in the Canadian government was to emphasize local and religious community. And the really aggressive actions of the Canadian government in 2020 caused me to rethink this view a little bit, and to think that a more direct approach might be appropriate. I've done a number of things since then, both behind the scenes and in front of the scenes, to try to develop networks of people capable of acting together and kind of resisting this moment. So that's a bit of the background for what I do. I have a couple of projects on the go. I have The Red Ensign, which is a publication which is primarily analytical, that looks at Canadian politics in intense detail through the lens of elite theory. And I have an ongoing show that I host with Radical Liberation, who's a former guest of you on this channel, Stephen Carson, where we do periodic reviews. The show's called Econ Minis. We follow a whole collection of economic stories over long arcs.
Right. See, and he is going to be appearing, just for anyone interested. Radlib will be on in the US Banquet, I believe.
Oh, is he? Okay, good.
But, so COVID, could you describe your politics before COVID, just in a bit more detail?
So my political views prior to COVID were... I had a right-wing identitarian view, which was paired with the broad view that right-wing identitarian position had no future in Canada. Anglo-Canadians have been a minority in Canada for some time. Anglo-Canadians interested in their own identity have been a minority in Canada for even longer than that. The country was put into the position that it's in politically quite a long time ago, right? The battle for Canadian identity occurred in the late 50s through the late 60s, during which time Canada received a new flag, a new national anthem, had much of its British imperial past erased quite intentionally, and was reconstructed as a kind of as an American kind of satellite state, though there was an effort at that time towards a kind of pan-Canadian French and English nationalism, which always felt like a bit of a foreign imposition to Anglo-Canadians. I'm sure it felt like a foreign imposition to Franco-Canadians as well. So I kind of always took the view that the idealist view of politics that I had was tempered with the reality that the country was going to be governed in a way which was unacceptable to me. And so the correct strategy was to focus on local community, focus on, I'm part of a very thick religious community in Canada. We have our own schools, our own universities, our own legal society. There's layers to it. And so I kind of thought that the correct locus for political energy was to build this parallel layer.
Right. Okay. And how did COVID change that?
Well, so all of the parallelism in Canada depended upon being left alone by the central government, more or less, which had been a good bet in Canada to that point. Canada has quite a large number of religious and ethnic minorities that the state kind of, you know, you pay your taxes and you don't violate any laws too egregiously, and they kind of leave you alone. But in COVID, the state decided that, for example, you weren't allowed to hold church anymore. The state decided that you weren't allowed to have Christmas dinner anymore. The state decided that they were going to make every element of public life a propaganda vessel. And I watched how effective they were at it, how far it penetrated into what I thought was a pretty thick community, pretty insulated from propaganda. And I saw people to whom, people who were 1 or 2 degrees separation from me go to jail without trial for holding church. So for those who didn't follow this, this is the case of the pastor at Trinity. There's three of these famous cases in Canada. There was Tim Stevens. There was, I'm blanking on the first case. And then there's the pastor of Trinity Church in Waterloo, where he didn't end up going to jail, but they levied very aggressive fines and confiscated the building and all this other stuff.
And the process is the punishment anyway.
Yeah. Well, it ended up costing, like, people lost their, elders of that church lost their house and, like, were just completely ruined financially as a consequence of doing, you know, what I would have thought is kind of behavior that any state should tolerate at any time. And so as a consequence of witnessing that, my view as to the likelihood that the state would kind of ignore us changed.
Yeah, I think this was a perception shared by many people around COVID. They realized how powerful the state can be, because a lot of the time the state in modern times pretends to be incompetent and might actually be incompetent, but I think it's mostly out of disinterest. When the state is interested in getting something done, it damn well gets it done, and it's very thorough. And Canada during COVID was extremely thorough. I happen to have personal knowledge of this because for various reasons, but it was similar in Australia and New Zealand as well, of course, and in Britain, indeed. But the point is that you realize that the state, it might be incompetent, it might be run by fools or lackeys or ideologues, whatever, but it can be extremely penetrative of everyday life if it wants to be. And I'm not surprised that changed your view of people in general. I think it did for lots of people.
It's a bit of a blunt instrument, but it hits very hard when it decides that it wants to hit. And the other thing that it taught me is that all of these, like a huge number of people who I thought that our efforts at parallelism had kind of insulated to the strategy of propaganda, that just wasn't the case. And so you know, I came to rethink quite a bit how effective our efforts had been at kind of building parallel communities. You know, if I look at my politics prior to COVID, I would have said, well, Canada has been pushing hard to dissolve traditional gender roles for the last like 50 years. And yet here they are, they're the norm inside my everyday life, right? You know, if I look at my own church, traditional gender roles are the dominant dynamic in every single family. You know, and yet resistance to propaganda on one front was not transferable. And if I had thought about it with respect to certain other priorities, particularly around migration of the state, I probably would have had a more circumspect position.
Yes.
But I hadn't thought about it and in quite that way until I watched people flip in front of my eyes in real time as a response to the promptings of power. And so I had to, you know, reevaluate not my views as to how politics worked exactly, but my views as to the position that I was in.
Yeah. It was a scary time for a lot of people. And what you're describing is one reason. You have to sort of reorientate yourself relative to the public in general, which is, I mean, for me, that was perhaps less of a leap because I was already an outsider being a nationalist. But for a lot of people, it was the first time that they felt alienated from their kith and kin.
Well, I kind of came to the view that the overwhelming majority of the public, including members of your family and people that you've known for a long time, were threats weaponized by power against you. And that's a very uncomfortable position for me. One of the properties of being like preternaturally on the identitarian right is that you really value your familial bonds, your bonds of community, to the point where those bonds, like I would never turn a member of my family over to the state, almost no matter what they did, because I mean that's just a property of being presuppositionally on the identitarian right. Your bonds of blood mean more to you than you know abstract principles, or certainly more than whatever the latest propaganda line is. And I quickly discovered that this was not a point of view that was broadly shared. Certainly not among the rank and file unthoughtful. Sorry, I didn't get you there. I'm not sure if it's on my end or your sound or what. Somebody in the chat, I'm not sure if it's on his end or if it's on my end. Can you repeat yourself?
Yes, so it's going on.
Okay, I can hear you a little better now.
Okay.
Sorry, can you repeat your question or comment?
Yeah, sure. Actually, it sounds competing.
Okay, we'll see. Okay. I asked, as a result of COVID, how did your political outlook change?
Okay, could you hear my answer to that question?
No.
Yeah, okay, so I answered that question, and then when you responded to it, I got muffled.
All right, strange. Okay, then. Okay.
I see in the X chat, people are saying the sound is odd on your end, Woz.
Okay, let me see what's going on.
There we go. That's better.
Yeah, that's better. Right?
Yeah, it's still got a bit of an echo, but not too bad.
Very strange. I have no idea what's going on. Okay, then. Okay, so this is going on, then. You need to talk about the general condition of Canada today, and that obviously takes into account COVID. So, may you take us around with that topic?
Yeah, sure. So, I wanted to speak about Canada because Canada is part of what I view as a growing effort to retrench the neoliberal order. In Canada, this is being done from the right. In the United Kingdom, you can see preparations to make a similar... Sorry, in Canada, this is being done from the left. You can see in the United Kingdom, this is being... There's an effort being prepared to do this from the right via reform, which is to moderate leftism in support of a neoliberal status quo. So if you look at the Carney government in Canada, we've had several politicians cross the aisle from the Conservative Party to the Liberal Party, the party that the Carney government is nominally representing. The government is almost better described as a national unity government than it is as a Liberal government. Carney, his personal politics are from the extreme right of the Liberal Party, except on the issue of gender LGBTQ. So if you look at his actions as Prime Minister, he's taken a whole series of actions intended to fortify the political position of the Laurentian elite, whose traditional political vehicle is the Liberal Party. There's the Memorandum of Understanding between the Canadian federal government and Alberta to try to quell Alberta separatism, the Alberta Sovereignty Act, and all of that political action. There's a huge patronage budget directed at Quebec to quell burgeoning Quebec separatism. There is pretty extreme efforts on the speech side to get to laws on speech in Canada that would more closely mirror what you find in the United Kingdom or maybe Germany. And there's a pretty aggressive effort to try to kind of revivify Canadian nationalism with Red America set up in opposition to it. And what this comes like, to give you an example here, Justin Trudeau was famously the first prime minister to publicly call Canada a post-national state with no particular identity and no particular association with an ethnic group. Whereas Mark Carney opened his campaign by talking about Canada's French and British heritage as integral parts of the nation. Mark Carney has also gone on to clamp down on foreign students as a visa program for entry to the United States. He's substantially moderated the temporary foreign workers program that saw more than a million people enter the country in a 18-month period after COVID. He has promised to reduce legal immigration by a substantial margin. And he has promised so some of that is promised, some of that is executed. And the idea here is to kind of take Canada's politics, which had gotten out of control under Trudeau, and try to get it back into control inside the dialectic, inside the neoliberal, neoconservative dialectic, and dominated by the Laurentian elite, which is one of Canada's three traditional elite classes, traditionally the dominant, or since the Second World War, the dominant one.
Okay. How's my audio now?
It's much better.
Oh, that's great. I just refreshed the page. So are you of the mind that wokery is on the wane now, that it's being put away, so to speak?
So this is, I have a nuanced view here. So I think that peak woke happened in something like 2021 or 2022, and we're in a in an ebb in that particular tide. And a lot of what is described as woke is, so when I say woke, I think of white liberal, usually female coded politics. The politics that had the CEO of Chick-fil-A shining a black rapper's shoes on national TV in 2021, I think it was, during the George Floyd riots. Whereas I see that as qualitatively different than the kind of ethno-narcissist politics that you see from a figure like Mamdani or the Somali population in the upper Midwest in the U.S. So in a place like Canada, where that kind of ethno-narcissist politics has less influence, you know, despite what you might think, Canada is still a lot whiter than the United States. And particularly from a political point of view, that's true. So I think you're seeing a moderation in woke politics, particularly on issues of race. Which is cynically geared to try to maintain power. I think you see this much more in Canada than you see in some other jurisdictions, where it's in the interests of Canada's Laurentian elite to moderate woke in order to break up power blocks of certain ethnic groups in the country that are threatening to become rivals to them.
Yeah, that's a thing in itself, isn't it? That they've incubated these ethnic minority groups in society, but those groups are now at such strength that they can start to, well, directly influence politics, and they are often not in favor of the same things as the neoliberal regime.
Yeah, the ethnic politics of minority groups is a threat to the neoliberal order in Canada. It's a threat to the neoliberal order in quite a number of other places as well, I suspect. But in Canada, the existence or the attempt to transform what used to be our Socialist Party into a Sikh ethnic party really, I think, was not appreciated by members of the establishment here. And so...
Right.
Some pretty direct steps were taken, not necessarily to end replacement migration, but to end the threat to the dominance of a particular group of people.
And is that connected with the huge, oh God, I can't remember. I thought it was Hindu, not Sikh. The huge statues are.
Yeah. So Canada has two groups of, because of when Canada's immigration policy opened up, we have like a very, very large fraction of the migrants to Canada are from the Indian subcontinent. Sikh migration is a bit older in Canada, and Hindu migration is a bit younger. Many people don't know this, but Canada is actually the base of operations for a group of people who are considered terrorists in India, who are Khalistani nationalists for an independent Sikh state in the Indian subcontinent. This group of people perpetrated the Air India bombings in, I think it was the late 90s or early 2000s. The leader of the NDP, the Socialist Party in Canada, was the brother of somebody wanted on terrorism charges in India. So, like a pretty direct enemy of the Modi government, which is a Hindu supremacist. It's led by Hindus anyway. That conflict has now come to the streets of Canada. So every year on Diwali, there's what I call the Battle of Brampton, where Hindus and Sikhs riot in opposition to each other. You know, in what used to be a Canadian city.
Well, this is the kind of thing that has recently started happening in Britain as well. I remember about 2 years ago, there was this big altercation between Hindus and Sikhs. I think it was in Leicester. Can't remember now. But yeah, this is this is what happens when there are large numbers of minorities in your society. You end up being confronted with these, the spectacle of them fighting ancient tribal feuds and battles that have nothing to do with Canada or Britain or wherever, but we've got to tolerate it and sort of and even intervene and police it and so forth. And this is not, see, this is one example of how multiculturalism, diversity, ends up being not what it was supposed to be, not what we were told it would be. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I mean, in Canada, this was kind of always what it was supposed to be. When Trudeau the Elder in the 70s introduced the policy of cultural mosaic, he did it very intentionally to take the Québécois from a position where they could claim to be the only alternate culture in Canada, right? They claimed Canada was a bicultural, binational state. And Trudeau the Elder took the position that the right way to combat Quebec nationalism was to create what he called the cultural mosaic, which was to create a whole bunch of other competing minority political interests and to dilute the ethnic politics of the Québécois. He did that. That strategy was executed in parallel with the effort to make Québécois nationalist politics, which was always ethnic politics of Quebec, of the Québécois, into language politics. This was after the FLQ crisis in the 70s, where Québécois leftist terrorists kidnapped two members of the federal government, actually executed one of them. And then following that, the Parti Québécois, a separatist party, took power in the province. And would ultimately lead to a referendum to try to separate the province. So I appreciate that the picture was always rosier, but if you actually listen to the way these people were speaking at the time and what they were writing, they were very much aware that the project here was to create countervailing forces in Canadian politics to dilute the traditional to dilute the traditional power block that was the Québécois.
Yeah. So it's this creation of chaos, really, so as to break the stronghold of one particular group. But if that's the reality, what is told to the public is that, they'll integrate all of these new... That we see, that's the cover story. But it seems like in Canada, that cover story wasn't really... used. It was more like, well, we have no identity, so there is nothing for them to integrate to. That seems to have been used quite early on in Canada. Am I right thinking that?
Well, I mean, Canada went through this process at the end of the Second World War, because if you look at Canada sort of from 1830 through to 1940, Canada was a dialectic between the British imperial identity and the local interests of the businessmen that were here. And because of the collapse of the British Empire, the elite and cultural group that kind of held its identity as Anglo were kind of deeply undercut, both in terms of the power politics of the country, but also in terms of their own identity. It was deep. It was a kind of a deep wound for Canada when the efforts by John Diefenbaker to make the Dominion to make the Commonwealth a meaningful organization were rejected by the Crown and the British political establishment. And so we ended up in this position where the Liberal Party of Canada got an opportunity to rewrite the identity of the country in their own image without any political force in opposition to them at the time. And so it was very easy to then argue when it was politically convenient that the Canadian identity was basically fake anyway, because it was true. The organic identity of English Canadians had already been erased as part of a previous political project. And so when it came time to make the argument for mass migration, it was a ready tool to hand to argue that there's no such thing as like an ethnic Canadian identity. You know, that's all fake anyway. So we might as well, you know, how is a Chinese person any less Canadian than you if there is no particular cultural or ethnic identity of the country anyway?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I remember Justin Trudeau actually saying that immigrants are more Canadian than the settled people because they want it more. They've
that's
done
correct.
More to earn it.
That's correct. This was a classic sort of woke white liberal argument that was used in Canada, that the act of actively choosing to become Canadian made you in some way more Canadian than someone who was born to it. Because, you know, of course, if you're born somewhere, you don't choose that identity particularly.
Yeah. You don't do anything to deserve it or earn it. It's just, I mean, this is like the height of civic nationalism where there is no organic genetic basis at all. It's just, can you compete in this race that we're all celebrating? Or do you not want to compete? Are you lazy, but you still feel entitled to this identity?
One of the real difficulties about sort of the neoliberal view of the world is that it privileges the individual's choices so far above that which is unchosen about a person that it almost erases as a feature of a person that which is unchosen. In fact, I suppose it seeks to erase everything that's unchosen about what a human is.
Yeah.
It leads to these kind of insane statements like an immigrant is more Canadian than a person born to it. But it also leads to these like profoundly disgusting policy outcomes, like the approach the Canadian government has taken to medical assistance in dying, where, you know, of course, if a person's free choice is more sacred than any other element of the person, then of course the correct thing to do is to offer offer euthanasia to anybody who wants it for any reason.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't make sense not to. That's an imposition on the person's free will and their right to assert whatever if you deny them the right to kill themselves.
So this is how you get a Canadian state that says euthanasia for the mentally ill is a totally valid and appropriate policy. We're going to pursue it, you know, full steam ahead, marrying this kind of radical idea where your choices define you in a way that your unchosen identity cannot, with the technocratic needs of a state in poor financial condition. And so, well, we'll just let everyone who we can kind of corner into choosing to kill themselves, and that'll be the right policy outcome.
Yeah, it's very perverse. I don't know what to say about it. It just seems like we've gone down a very bad path here, because it's like rationality pushed to the extreme. So there's nothing left except what we happen to choose and rationalize in the moment. And we don't have any obligations to each other to stop this, to stop other people from making terrible choices.
Well, I view this as like a genetic bottleneck event, because, I mean, we've talked about euthanasia on one side, but the elephant in the room here is childbearing, where if you privilege chosen bonds over unchosen bonds, there's no sense in which the bond between parent and child is sacred, which means that the person who's your child is in no way more sacred than, you know, some other child that somebody else has had to make tremendous sacrifices in order to bring into the world and educate and you know, bring to successful adulthood as well. In that view of the world, there's a Nash equilibrium that says that results in nobody having any children at all, except the ones they might have by accident, right? And of course, we have abortion for that. So you have this, to the extent that people are able to convince themselves to actually believe this proposition, that the only thing that matters about you are the chosen aspects of your identity. To the extent that that's actually believed by people, it's an entirely rational outcome that these people would have no children. And because these people have no children, the civilization and the paradigm in which they inhabit is inherently unstable, brittle, and tyrannical, because despite the liberal view of humanity, most beliefs are heritable, either by early enculturation or by genetics. And so you have this tremendous generational transition event, right? If I look at my own community, fertility rates are like 4 or 5 per family. If I look at, you know, the other part of the world I have one foot in, which is the world of Canadian finance, if you have more than one child, you're an anomaly. And so there's an obvious endpoint to this that has to be forestalled by really aggressive interventions.
Mass immigration
is one of them. Really, really intensive use of the public school apparatus to try to propagandize children is another, or one of them. The ideologizing of post-secondary filters for the kind of state apparatus is another element of this. What you have to do is you have to go full repressive tolerance to hold on to power in this diminishing, in this, as you feel your group's grip slipping.
Right. So what you're saying is that there's a sort of genetic selection event going on here, whereby only conservative, and I use that term very broadly, only conservative people are going to have kids, because the more liberal progressives will rationalize themselves out of having kids and thus go extinct.
That's correct. And in that environment where you've got you've got a ruling class dominated by a segment of the population which is diminishing in gen pop, you have this profound feeling of fragility among them that results in all of this crazy behavior where they lash out. And I suspect that that can actually be sustained for quite a long time, but it's a very uncomfortable world to live in.
Yes. About the detaching of children from their parents, one manifestation that we see of that is in the trans thing, where kids who are going into this are encouraged not to tell their parents, or are warned that their parents might object to it. So they get the idea themselves that they shouldn't tell their parents. And so then the parents don't know about what their kid is doing. I was actually hearing a personal testimony about this the other day in Britain. And I'm sure the same thing has gone on in Canada. And so, well, do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I mean, in Canada, it's a common Child Protective Services intervention to remove an LGBTQ child from the custody of their parents because of their parents' lack of affirmation of their identity. So what you see is these identities adopted under the social conditions of the public school. And then you have a moment where there's a confrontation between the authority of the public school and the authority of the parents. And in a neoliberal state, there can only be one end to that confrontation of authority.
Yeah. So the state has this perfect way to detach kids, because under that system of thinking, the parents are oppressing and abusing the kid by not allowing him or encouraging him to go down this path. So they're victimizing their own child. Therefore, and they might be perfectly sensible, responsible people in every other way, but even just that way alone means that rightly the state should take their kids away from them.
That's right, yeah.
And I think you mentioned tyranny earlier on, and I think this is one example of it, but there are so many where if you dissolve all of these bonds between people, then the only option is for the state to intervene everywhere.
That's
in
correct.
Relationship.
The consequence of this radical individualism is a situation where there's no intermediary between you and the state apparatus, which is like a terrifying kind of, it is totalitarianism at its, like, it is the most totalitarian system you could imagine creating, I suppose.
Yeah, it is. But you seem to think that this doesn't have much of a lifespan.
I don't know how long it can go on. The slice of society that's interested in pursuing this is fairly thin, and it is not reproducing very effectively generationally. So if I look at the people committed to the neoliberal order in Canada, it's a pretty thin slice of society. They're mostly women, and they're struggling to hold on to their position in power. And their tyrannical action is kind of tearing the country apart underneath them. Canada is naturally a pretty difficult place to govern. It's very regionally diverse. It's got a lot of natural local elites that have interests that are out of alignment with the central government. So it's hard to say exactly how long it can go on. My position is that it can go on as long as the government can rely on outside aid support from the United States. And that the day that the support of the United States can no longer be assured is the first day that we march towards the end of the Canadian regime.
Right. Okay. Are you off the... I realize that there's quite a polarization here about people wanting, some Canadians wanting America, Trump, to take over Canada, and others who think that's dreadful, a terrible idea. Where do you stand on that?
I mean, I have a variety of views here. I am a cultural skeptic of the United States. I'm the descendant of loyalists who fought on the other side of the American Revolution and were resettled in Canada. I think that the American project, there's something deep inside it, which is opposed to natural hierarchy. So I'm a cultural skeptic of the United States on that basis, though I have a great deal of personal affection for many Americans, and even for many parts of America in which I've worked. There is a tactical question of how the relationship with the United States should be managed at a time where the Canadian government is quite objectively more evil than the American government, and much more interested in doing things that, bother me and people like me. And then there's, after that tactical question, there's the longer term question of, well, if you allow Canada to pass from an informal vassal of the United States to a more formal arrangement, what are the 100-year consequences of that for my children? I tend to think that it would be a bad thing to have the Canadian state evaporate and fold parts of the country into the United States. I think the right way to govern Canada is to weaken the central government, build up the regional governments, and wait for a new day. That's my view as to the best immediate political future. I also think that I'm deeply interested in the preservation of my culture and my people, and the assimilative force that exists inside the United States is so much larger than the assimilative force that exists in a place like Canada, I would, even if we have to be poor, even if we have to suffer in order to avoid that erasure, I think it's better I think it's better in the long array to continue on that position, and that's even true in my mind if Canada breaks up as a country. I think we would be better off to be nominally independent nations than to fold any part of this country into the United States, because I think folding parts of this country into the United States would result in the assimilation of the various ethnic groups that make up Canada, or at least the assimilation to a much greater degree.
Yeah. I guess that brings us to one of the topics that you wanted to address, which is parallelism and pressure group politics as strategies.
Yeah, one of the things that I've spent a lot of my time as a content creator focused on is how do you act politically in a moment like this? And there's really two obvious strategies that present themselves. There's three obvious strategies, one of which I'm going to dismiss. The first of these strategies is to attempt to engage directly in electoral politics. This is something you've seen in Canada with the PPC. You've seen it in the UK with the effort to create, going all the way back to the BNP and going all the way forward to Farage and the Reform Party. There's a kind of deep tradition of trying to unseat the misuse of sovereignty by a direct electoral attack. You can contrast this with two other approaches that we've seen. One is the kind of pressure group politics, and another is the politics of parallelism. Now, I would submit to you that parallelism and pressure group politics are very effective at two separate things. I'll give you an example of what I mean by pressure group politics. This is an example from Team Evil. So there's a think tank is the best way to describe them, a group in Canada called the Century Initiative that exists to lobby the government to increase migration to Canada so that Canada's population reaches 100 million by the year 2100. To give some perspective to those who aren't Canadian, there's about 40 million people in Canada. There's something like 20 million Anglo and French Canadians, maybe 25 million Anglo and French Canadians. So that would take Canada to a position where its traditional population represents something like 20% of its population by the end of the century. This group of people, one of its co-founders just became the Canadian ambassador to the United States and is tightly integrated with the Carney administration as they were with the Trudeau administration before that. And so they've been extremely effective. They are responsible for the post-COVID wave of migration as a means of, the post-COVID wave of migration in Canada, which was enormous, something like 2.5-3 million strong in a country of 40 million, was a policy recommendation of the president of the Century Initiative to the Trudeau government for how to repair the economic damage that came out of COVID. So they've been extremely effective at getting their policy agenda across, not by running for office, but by sitting outside in the wilderness, having, paying people to develop policy and lobbying the government to adopt that policy. So a number of people who I would consider, vaguely who I know politically, I don't really know them personally, decided to do the opposite. They formed a group called the Dominion Society, which exists as a think tank pressure group attempting to push in the opposite direction for remigration, right? So what all they do all day, every day, is make the argument through media and through political channels that what Canada really needs in order to prosper is to send all these people back.
Remigration.
Exactly. And so that's one strategy for politics. You can see by its effectiveness on Team Evil how the kind of people who are formally in government very often will look to pick up policy agendas that are pre-made for them. They're not particularly interested in sitting down and developing their own ideas and developing detailed responses. And so the existence of these policy programs outside of government is very valuable. Equally, the effort to persuade, particularly at an elite level, independent of the threat to dispossess people of power, is a very effective tactic. So I think this approach has some value in achieving particular policy objectives that are urgent in nature. I think its limitation is that ultimately, the Canadian elite are pretty rotten to the core and are spiritually unbonded from the Canadian people and therefore need to be replaced. There's no pathway from pressure politics to replacing the Canadian elite with an elite that is bonded to the Canadian people through a combination of shared interest and shared sort of spiritual bond. So there's a limit to what can be achieved through pressure politics. But I do think it's a very effective tactic. Parallelism, on the other hand, has the opposite strength and weakness program profile, where parallelism is a very effective way to build up an elite that actually represents your community and is bonded by interest and bonded with a kind of shared spirit, shared culture, shared blood. But it's not very effective at getting policy goals over the top in any kind of term that people might be interested in. You know, you take on parallelism because you're interested in the 100-year future of your people, not because you're interested in getting a policy issue over the top in the next decade.
Yeah. Well, this is the... while you were talking about that pressure group that made that suggestion to the policy suggestion to Trudeau's government, I was thinking, well, yeah, but Trudeau's government would be amenable to that suggestion. They would like that suggestion. And this is, I think, what you're referring to when you say that the elite themselves need to be swept away. They themselves need to be replaced. It's not just a matter of telling them, you know, better ideas. They won't like the better idea. They won't like the idea of a native Canadian identity because they've been fighting against it for 50 years.
Well, if you look at the issue of remigration, right? So you can sell the issue of remigration to the Canadian elite and say, like, you have serious financial problems that are a threat to your power in the country. You know, here's a mountain of evidence that says migration is actually exacerbating the financial problems in the country. Therefore, remigration or immigration restrictionism is an appropriate kind of neoliberal technocratic tool to address your problem. And if you make that argument loudly and strongly enough, you may convince them from time to time when this is a particular pain point to adopt your position. But what you're not going to get is any kind of, you're not going to merge the people and the elite in terms of interest and in terms of kind of a common spirit or a common identity. So you will only be able to get issues over when there's a convergence of interest between that elite and the policy proposal you happen to be putting forward at the time.
There's a YouTube channel that's just I've just discovered recently in Britain. It's an English guy in England, English, and the channel's called Integral Views. And what's really interesting, well, just to preface why I'm saying this, what you're talking about is making it in the interests of neoliberals to reverse immigration, to do remigration. You've got to make it in their interests. Now, this YouTube channel, this guy, Integral Views, people can go and look at it in their own time. He comes across as a Guardian reader. He comes across as a liberal progressive, not far, like not extreme, not loopy, like a crazy ideologue, but definitely just by his nature, a liberal. And yet he has made a string of videos recently about migration and the problem of mass immigration into Britain and how it's ruining everything, infrastructure, cultural incompatibility, etc. And basically, the reason I mentioned this is he seems to be doing exactly what you're hoping the Canadian elites will do one day.
Yeah.
Where he's coming from a neoliberal perspective, but he's concluding that mass immigration is antithetical to everything that he values.
Well, and I think this is a sale job that can be made across the Anglosphere. I mean, if I look at the Carney government, I think they're a perfect candidate to adopt this strategy to become immigration restrictionists in the name of protecting their own power. Now, I don't think that's a long-term solution to the problems that beset our respective peoples, but I think it's an essential tactic along the way. And so if I look at the Dominion Society and what they're trying to do as a pressure group, I think there's a lot of value in trying to get that argument over, trying to get that argument across, knowing that there also has to be other strategies in play.
Yes. Of course. I don't think any one strat, because we're dealing with multiple things here, so no one strategy is going to work. And indeed, our opposition, when they re-engineered the world, they attacked it from 20 different ways at once. And sowed seeds in academia, in the media, in everything, in education, everywhere.
And operated with a degree of generational persistence that I think is, you have to genuinely admire it. If we plan to reconstruct our societies, we have to have the same discipline, the same kind of iron will, and the same long view as to the journey that's ahead of us. We cannot become, I said earlier that I'm a great critic of the Trump administration. And one of the reasons I am is that, would I have voted for Trump over Kamala Harris? Of course I would have voted for Trump over Kamala Harris. But what I don't see in the Trump administration is evidence of this kind of iron determination to forge a future for your people that will last, 100+ years. What I see is a kind of
pragmatic.
Yeah, not even he reminds me of that sort of archetypal American sort of quick sale character who kind of flim flams a little bit. And I look at so many of the things that are out of the mouth one day, and then 3 months later, it turns out that a lot of his donors really like H-1B visas, and so I guess we're really not going to charge $100,000 for each one. And it turns out that Indian Americans are really influential inside Silicon Valley, so we're going to just kind of ignore the relationship between Indian Americans and the H-1B visa system. Right. I don't see the kind of depth and commitment that would be needed to remake America in a new image. And for that, one of the articles that I am most think is most important out of my own work this year is an article that I titled "It's Time for the Right to Grow Up." And
what I was going to move on to next.
What I mean by that is that if you look at maybe the easiest way to make this argument is to look at the situation currently playing out in Brazil, where Jair Bolsonaro is currently in prison after failing to contest in any serious way a highly dubious election fought from and then returning to Brazil after a brief exile in the United States, only to be imprisoned upon returning to Brazil on what are pretty obviously political charges. Bolsonaro, at the moment his supporters were out in the streets begging for a military coup, was in Miami eating KFC. I often will joke on Twitter, it's the most expensive KFC meal I've ever known. It's cost him the rest of his life and the political right in his country the rest of their future. Yeah. Because fundamentally he if you look at Bolsonaro's rhetoric through the time that he was president of Brazil is what they call it, where he was the leader of Brazil, he acted as though he was a right-wing caudillo, a right-wing authoritarian leader, but he didn't behave that way. In fact, he was quite unserious about the aspirations of his opposition. So unserious that he allowed the Supreme Court to overturn pretty serious criminal convictions against one of his major political opponents, and then allowed him to run for president, and then allowed something of a farce of the electoral process in the northern provinces of Brazil that are a pretty famous political machine at this point. And all through this process, he, you know, technically he was in charge of the state, and yet he refused to use the power of the state to stop what was happening and what was easily foreseeable as a consequence of not intervening. And he refused.
I would say this. I mean, this is very typical of conservatives. Sorry to interrupt. I just want to make this brief interjection. Sure. It's very typical of conservatives. And I would say the same of Trump in 2020, when he had refused to get the social media companies under control, and then they all banned him. While he was still in the dying days of his presidency, it was tragic and pathetic to watch. Sorry to interrupt.
No, absolutely. I mean, we all watched between 2018 and 2020. I think it was 2018 when people started getting banned from YouTube. But we watched this process play out, knowing what the end point was. And, he refused to take it seriously. He refused to take ownership of the problem. And I've seen this over and over again by the political right in the Anglosphere, to just, you know, what is it that the British Conservative Party got caught breaking lockdown rules for? Well, it was like, drinking and cavorting. It wasn't doing anything of serious moment, right?
Yeah.
And so in my view, the time has really come. The online right, if you go back, like one of the things I love about millennials is this time capsule of what the online right was in various eras. And if you go back and watch the first or second millennial, you will find an enormous amount of what I call gamma male energy, which is valid criticism of leaders from the perspective of an outsider, heavily tinted with humor, right? The online right thought that they were going to laugh their way into making a correction to the political order. And that strategy, I don't want to be overly critical of it for what it was in its time, but the days of laughing at politics from the right are more or less over.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
And we're reaching a point where the leadership class of whatever remains of the authentic right needs to have what Lee Kuan Yew talked about. He talked about how to lead Singapore, you needed to have iron in your spine in order to, in his case, he was talking about managing the inter-ethnic dynamics that existed in Singapore and not allowing the state to tip over into a patronage-driven democracy, which in his view would have inevitably led to factional violence and the degeneration of the nation. I think that the same kind of seriousness and the same kind of force of personality is required in order to lead the politics of the right into the future. And it's required not just of people attempting formal political leadership, but it is required of the class who are trying to go from doing commentary and having political views to trying to actually affect politics in their own countries.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there has always been a tendency in conservatives to just laugh at the left. And this is something I first saw this crystallized 2012, 2013. And it was a guy saying that the left is a clown with a knife. I've forgotten his name now. Damn. But anyway, he made this point that the right will respond to the clown with a knife by laughing at him for being a clown, but they'll forget about the knife and they'll overlook that, you know, he's actually deadly. He's very serious. And I think this has probably happened for a lot. I think you can see G.K. Chesterton alluding to this kind of thing as well, that the right always underestimate the left, always think that they're not really serious, and always think that they're incompetent and silly and won't get anywhere, while the left calmly take over society. And that's what happened over the last 100 years. And in our age, I think, yes, there has been the lingering exhaust fumes of that attitude, but also a sense that, well, the left are on their last legs. I mean, there's more recently a certain optimism about that. And, you know, I use the term left as a catch-all for what we know we're talking about here, which is the enemy, our opposition. Well,
this is one of the other things that I was going to get to. When I look at the situation in Canada, you have a recapitulation of the neoliberal regime from the left, right? Mark Carney ran a campaign from the Liberal Party of Canada, which is a traditionally leftist party. But he ran a campaign that leaned heavily into nationalism. His slogan was "Elbows Up," which is a reference to you know, how to play dirty in hockey in the country. I see this neoliberal retrenchment as possible both from the nominal left and from the nominal right. So if I look at what may well be about to happen in your country with reform, I suspect that a Farage government will be a neoliberal retrenchment under the nominal right.
Yes, I agree.
And one of the things that I think is really important for people in our intellectual space is to figure out how to maintain frame and how to maintain your relationship with the coalition that wants to end this nonsense without the benefit of being able to offer patronage to them and without the benefit of being able to prevent the regime from adopting your nominal rhetoric. So Nigel Farage is perfectly happy to stand up there and talk about stopping the boats, and he'll even talk about legal immigration to some degree, even though I don't think that there's any real evidence that he has that he intends to restore the United Kingdom to a government led from, that is in spiritual union with its people, let's put it that way. Led for their benefit.
He wouldn't even recognize it's that the people exist.
That's correct. And so how do you maintain frame? How do you maintain your footing in an environment where elements of the neoliberal regime are willing to adopt your talking points and adopt your like nominal elements of your position without actually embodying your position, without actually making structural change. And I think this is a great challenge for the right, or for our people in the future, because there is almost no language, there's almost no political label you can adopt. I mean, in Canada, the latest thing is to call yourself a nationalist as opposed to a leftist or a rightist in this intellectual space. But Mark Carney led the most nationalist campaign for government in Canada's recent history. The father of Canadian nationalism is Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who was like a radical leftist and was responsible for the beginning of mass migration in the country. There's no rhetorical position that these people can't adopt. And so there's got to be a strategy besides just trying to separate yourself in terms of language from the way these people from the regime, because if language is all that separates you, then or all that bonds you to your audience, then that bond will be challenged and will be broken for a significant chunk of the audience. If you look at what one of the things that I think is so depressing about the Trump administration is the way in which it threatens to absorb a lot of the energy that was directed towards reforming the country without actually executing on reform.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think this is true of both the Trump administration and reform in Britain, where energy gets funneled into something only so that it can be wasted. And then the people are demoralized and they conclude that there's nothing that can be done, so we're just going to have to put up with things. And I think the British state is very good at doing this, very good at setting this stuff up and executing it. And I do think that Reform UK is basically one big operation of that nature.
Well, and in some cases it's done consciously. I also think that it's done unconsciously by committed neoliberals who don't understand that a world outside that frame exists, right? So I think if you sat down and had a head-to-head in private with Nigel Farage, I don't think he would understand the world as you see it. I don't think he could imagine himself as embodying the nation in the way that, I don't know, Henry Tudor imagined himself as embodying the nation. That's just, it's out,
absolutely
completely outside of his, I don't think he even thinks that there are people who think that way.
Yeah, except nutcases. I think he would have contempt for people who think that way.
Yeah, I think he thinks those people are like unserious, doing it cynically. One of the reasons it's easy for him to frame them as far right or like terrorists or whatever is because he thinks that they're outside of like normal human thought. And it never occurs to him that this is the philosophy of like 95% of human history.
Well, exactly. And I think this, I mean, it's easy to blame this on boomers and to pin this on them, but I think this attitude is shared by a lot of modern people. They're so detached that they don't realize, like the phrase, my people, that today to most individuals, that phrase sounds silly and romantic and delusional. They don't realize it's how everyone thought up until about, 1960?
Yeah, 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. And that's how most people still think today. It's just us. It's just white people who would object to that phrase, my people, meaning my ethnic group.
It's interesting because a lot of the trends towards deracination and the collapse of, like all the metrics that collapse as a consequence of deracination, are all, this narrative's actually all being played out in a very similar way across what we would think of as the third world, right? So one of my favorite things to do on Twitter is point out to people that fertility in India has been one-shotted by modernity in a more profound way than it has been anywhere else in the world besides Germany, right? In a period of like 30 or 40 years, fertility in India has declined from like a TFR of like 7 to a TFR below replacement in most of the country. This is a property of modernity that is, there's a lot of pieces that go into it. But you can't look at people's outside of the West who have not yet gone through this blender and say they've got it right. I think it's correct to say these people are on the front side of this blender. They're going to face this challenge too. We need to find a way to be the first people to emerge on the other side of it.
Yeah. Again, this selection event that you referred to earlier. I agree. I think that we need to think about how do we make sure that we do survive this. because a lot of us aren't going to, and we need to be the people who are there after this is over.
And so a lot of my work has been focused on trying to figure out how to do that. I worked for the Beowulf Foundation for a long period of time, during which we took on what we called the Basket Weaving Project, which was a project to try to reform organic communities. I've worked at Parallelism pretty intensively within my own community, and I've worked at various other projects to try to form networks to try to pass through this moment. But it's not at all easy to figure out what all the ingredients are to try to reconstitute an authentic organic identity on the other side of all of the organic elements of your culture being destroyed by liquid modernity and the heritage that is left of them being in the hands of your neoliberal enemies.
Yeah, I mean, there are, in terms of fertility, there have been several government projects in Hungary and Denmark for sure. I think Italy also at least talked about it, to encourage people to have more kids. I think the real issue there is cultural. If it's not in the culture to have an expectation that the vast majority of people will have kids, if that expectation isn't in the culture, then, well, that's what matters.
Well, I also think they're fundamentally misguided. So many of these efforts are predicated on the idea that people don't have enough material resources in order to have children. Well, rewind a couple of generations. I'm a huge fan of posting early photography from the late 19th and early 20th century. And one of the things I love to post are pictures of these gigantic families living in absolute squalor, either in rural settings or in the high trust urban societies of the United Kingdom or Ireland. And the reason I post these things is to point out that even in relative poverty, there were people at that time who so believed in the necessity of putting themselves forward into the future that they would make enormous sacrifices. You know, all over the world, there are fathers right now going hungry so that their sons can eat. This is historically normal. It's good and it's right. And yet in the West, we have grandparents gorging themselves on the inheritance of their grandchildren. It's easy to kind of think of that as a material problem, but it really is like a spiritual or a kind of viewpoint problem about what really is the purpose of your life and what your relationship is to your collective identity, what your relationship is to your children. I think these issues of identity are essential. They're far more germane to the issue of fertility than is, you know, housing affordability.
Yeah, it is a very difficult nut to crack. I just come back to this, that if it's not in the films people watch, the TV dramas that people watch, in the music that they listen to, then it's not going to be high in their list of priorities.
Well, that element, but there's also like, if I don't believe that my child is a continuation of me put forward into the future, then why am I making these tremendous sacrifices in order to, you know, especially if my material circumstances are different, why am I going to give up my hedonic maximization in order to put something forward into the future? If that person is just a free individual whose choices matter more than their relationship to me.
And the thing is, the environment now is such that you couldn't put that message across without being accused of being racist, because what is it that the person would be continuing into the future if not their ethnic group? Therefore, if you advocate that, you are you are being a racist.
Well, you're not just being a racist, you're totally undercutting the entire neoliberal project, which is built on the idea, like, it's built on Karl Popper's sort of anti-fascist ideology that argues that you need to kind of put away these strong bonds of identity in order to prevent, you know, the mid-century Germans, basically.
Yeah, yeah, of course. But do you think that that's losing hold, that the fear of that?
I go back and forth. It certainly is losing cultural currency. On the other hand, they still hold all the gates. They still hold all the keys. So if you, I think the British state is a really good illustration of this. You know, the taboo against being thought of as a racist is probably weaker than it was 10 years ago. On the other hand, the legal apparatus that exists to go after you is objectively quite a bit stronger. So I yeah. don't know how to think about, or I haven't reached a conclusion as to what I think about that change in dynamic and how durable it is. I think it's more durable than people would like to admit. In people's head, they have this kind of fantasy where the behavior of the British state is the kind of behavior of a brittle tyrant, and one of these days is just going to come tumbling down and everybody's going to peacefully go back to normal free speech. I don't think that's happening at any point in your lifetime. I think that the end, that this is going to climax in a very, in some very difficult moments.
Oh, that's a grim foretelling. There have been a few super chats, so I'll put them to you. Dardy said, "I always enjoy hearing the Black Horse's perspective, even when it concerns Canada. On his Substack podcast, it can be summarized as, 'It's over.' Just being cheeky. Great stream." Well, thank you, Dardy. Caller says, "Canadian politics is looking very grim. Will it take 15 years of Tory failure in order for us to get a reform, like Reform UK equivalent?" What would you think of that, 15 years of Tory failure?
I don't think that there's going to be a reform-like movement in Canadian politics. Canadian politics is degenerating into a situation where the Liberal Party is representative of one elite group, the Conservative Party is representative of another elite group, the Parti Québécois is representative of a third elite group. There's very little ideological content in any of these parties at this point. So I don't think, because the parties are so bonded to these interest groups, I don't think it's possible to use nominal ideological positions to absorb energy back into politics. I think what you're headed for in Canada is a substantial reduction in power in the center, in the central government, and a regionalization of the country. And I think the Carney government is failing to prevent, is failing in its efforts to prevent this.
Well, I mean, that seems quite an optimistic outlook, that the center cannot hold, it's the central command, as it were, is breaking down.
Well, it would be if the West, if the regional elites weren't also like kind of evil neoliberals, right? So, there's this,
yeah, presumably they're easier to take over.
Yeah, well, that is my long view, that the regional elites are easier to take over. So I actually think that this is positive, especially in the longer or durée, but I think it's going to be a very difficult period to live through.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's unavoidable. Okay, Judge Lott says, "Cheers." Thank you very much. And Brulham, sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, says, "Could you comment on the dynamics of the Western and Laurentian elite versus British American opposition politics and the size of recent immigration to Canada, where they settle and how this affects politics in rural cities? I think it would be helpful for American and British friends to understand our nation." So the dynamics of the Western and Laurentian elite versus British American opposition politics.
Yeah, so there's a lot here to unpack. Canada went through an elite fracture under the rule of Trudeau the Elder, where a consolidated elite in the post-war period collapsed into these three descendant elites, all of which are progressive, but all of which are defined by regional interests. There's an elite in Western Canada whose interests are deeply tied to the oil and resource extraction industries. There's an elite in the Montreal-Toronto corridor. You've heard me refer to them as the Laurentian elite a couple of times. This is the remnants of the core elite group that has dominated Canadian politics for the last 100 years. And there's a Quebecois elite that managed Quebec as almost an ethno-nationalist project at a sub-national level. They all have independent economic interests and increasingly are in control of three parties as representatives of their political interests in federal politics. The Western elite have been engaged in a long war for control of the Conservative Party. I would say that at this point, they're pretty firmly in control of that party, but they are being challenged by ideological conservatives who would like to take it back and run kind of 1980s Reaganism on that platform.
Right.
So that's kind of the elite dynamics of the country. These elite groups are locked in regional contests for sovereignty, and you can see it in the battle between the Western provincial governments and the federal government of Canada. So over the last couple of years, there have been a couple of pieces of legislation, the Alberta Sovereignty Act, the Saskatchewan First Act, that were expressed attempts at nullification of federal environmental law aimed at getting pipelines and oil and gas development in service of the Western elite on track and on schedule for the in opposition to the Laurentian elite that controlled the central government, who were attempting to use Environment Canada to strangle their political rivals' source of funding. So those politics really, Canada's politics have quite a bit of ideological unity compared to the United States or compared to the United Kingdom. But unlike the United States and the United Kingdom, the regional interests are really, really powerful and really bonded in physical location because the resources that they depend on for their sources of financing reside in physical locations. They can't be divorced from that from their geography. Now, the other comment that's here is an interesting one. So almost the entirety of the modern wave of migration to Canada, the post-1980 wave, has settled in urban Canada in a couple of very specific locations, in Vancouver, in the Greater Toronto area, and in the area around Montreal, with some minor exceptions. Those cities are now, Toronto and the Greater Toronto area and the Greater Vancouver area are now overwhelmingly non-white, from a position where prior to 1980 they would have been, as white as the United Kingdom was. Conversely, the rural part of the country is still dominated by the historical population groups. And all efforts to encourage migrants to go and settle in rural Canada and take up jobs in the resource industry or in developing the Northern Territories have utterly failed because of how difficult life is there, especially without the kind of cultural, to go and pioneer, to go in and be a frontiersman on the Canadian frontier and do it and with joy and to thrive at it really requires a cultural toolkit that is quite deep. And it requires a level of physical determination that these groups just, don't seem to have. It doesn't seem to matter how much you want, you're willing to pay people to roughneck in northern Alberta. The only people who will do it are a very particular kind of ethnic group. So even in like the 20, even in the period after the Iraq War, when people were making like the equivalent of $400,000 or $500,000 a year to go and drive, you know, dump trucks and roughneck in northern Alberta, the only people who would do it were people from a very specific ethnic background.
Right. Yeah.
And so all efforts by the Canadian elite to try to end this dynamic where the migrant groups are just like an urban service work class have broadly failed. And so we have this very strange urban-rural divide where the country almost doesn't exist anymore in the urban areas. And rural Canada looks more or less untouched, particularly urban rural Canada when you get more than 100 miles away from the Canadian border.
Well, that would seem to point to a way forward for people who are, you know, on our side of things.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons why one of my most long-standing political views is that you should have a focus on your local politics and on your local community, because it's a nexus, it's a political nexus from which your people can kind of put themselves forward into the future, even in spite of this kind of large urban service worker class. You can kind of, you know, walk down parallel paths, knowing that as the Canadian state barrels towards bankruptcy, the ability to subsidize this giant, very unproductive urban service worker class is going to diminish. Canada already has something like 150,000 people a year who leave the country, overwhelmingly of migrant background. And if you talk to the people who do this, it's overwhelmingly because they just say, life is too hard here, I'm going somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just so emblematic of the macro, where they don't build these countries. The white people built them, and they come to these countries and take what they can from them, but don't build them.
It's just a looting operation. And I mean, there's nothing we can do about it in the short term, but eventually all the money's going to be gone. And it turns out being poor in Canada is very hard. You know, my ancestors came to what is now Ontario when it was a frozen wilderness of virgin timber. And they felled the trees and pulled the roots out with ox carts in order to build a little England here. I don't foresee the migrant groups who have come to Canada since 1980 ever engaging in a project like that. They'll just go home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's hope so. Eventually, I think that will be the most attractive option for them.
Yeah, I mean, different places have different dynamics here. I'm much less sure about what will happen, particularly in Southern Europe, where the dynamics are quite a bit different. But in Canada, apart from the welfare state, it's a very, very hard place to just exist. So you kind of have to, you kind of have to be economically productive, or find something, or find somewhere else to live in most of this country, in any period where the country isn't rich. And there have been many periods where Canada has not been a rich country.
Yeah, yeah. It seems a strange thing to hope for, but given the circumstances, I find myself hoping that all of our countries become poorer so that these people leave of their own accord.
This is one of the things that separates me from a lot of other commentators on the online right. I think that one of the great problems with the West is that we're too rich. We have a kind of spiritual poverty, in part as a result of our material abundance. And I say that not our immediate material abundance, but our material abundance over the last 200 years has eroded kind of essential features of who we are as a people and what we've been able to pass to our children. And I actually think that it would be good for all of us to experience some poverty and some hardship, because I think it would produce I think it would produce virtue in us in a way that we've kind of lost.
Oh yeah, I agree. Well, look, this has been a very good conversation, a very good interview. So thank you very much for it. Is there anything that you'd like to say just before we finish?
No, I mean, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. As I say, I've listened to Millennial many times. I would highly encourage people to go back through the archive and understand the evolution of what's gone on what's broadly known as the online right. You're sitting here in a particular meta, in a particular metapolitical moment where particular kinds of commentators are out there. But the Starmer government, 2025 aren't going to last forever. And try to understand yourself and your views in this kind of longer durée to carve out a position and a strategy that's going to work for you and going to work for all of us here, out with a little bit of perspective on the moment. And don't, like, there's a tendency in online politics to become completely obsessed with what's happened, like, right in the last week.
Yeah, of course. I think it's a good idea to have a long perspective. Okay, all right then. Well, let's end it there. This has been a good one. I'll be back in 20 minutes with the next interview, let me just see who that's with. Jeff Younger. So that should be quite interesting. But in the meantime, Black Horse, thank you for watching Millennial for all these years, and thank you for accepting the invitation this year. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to get to know you, and anybody who's interested in my work, you can follow me on I think you've got all the links on millennial.com, so you can find my work that way.
Yeah, and they're in the description on these videos as well. Okay, well, thank you very much, and everyone else, I will see you soon. Bye bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.